You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello, and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 132. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. Well, okay, last episode. What do I do? I left myself in a bit of a pickle because I talked about something controversial, and I have really awesome listeners. I find this out more every week the show goes by, but especially on weeks like this, because I got a lot of comments on Christina Hoff Sommers, and they were all good. And I don't just mean people agreed with me, because actually I don't think I got too many comments from people who agreed with me. And I'll say I don't think I really made like a very pro Christina Hoff Sommers stance. I think I was more just against people who were using weird tactics to try to silence her, not listen to her. But I got a lot of comments that were very thoughtful, very long too, long, thoughtful, and that's fine. I don't mind that at all. Thanks for your, if it was a long, stupid comment or a long, insulting comment, then that'd be one thing. But I read it all. So, but the problem is I 100% I'm committed to doing, Portable Atheist today because I said I would do it. I'm ready to do it. I haven't done it in a very long time, and I don't think I can just do an episode of answering those comments, but I very much want to now because I got so many long, good comments with lots of great points to address. So man, I want to do that, but I don't think I can. I'll see if I can do it next week, but I also have stuff banked still. I still have a lot of episodes banked. So I'll figure it out. Let it suffice to say that at some point in the future, I will address the very good comments on Christina Hoff Sommers. And it will be on the show. I won't just, not just like a comment back or something. I'll do it on the show because they're a little too good to ignore. Also book club, man, I really need to send out an email to everybody. I've gotten some people want a Facebook group. Some people don't. I'm also thinking now, let me know if you'll hate me for this, guys. And I know I'm talking to thousands of people and yet only probably like 20 people care about this because that's how many people signed up, which is a good number of people, but whatever. I'm sure you guys are listening, so I'm just going to address you here. I feel like being kind of unfair and trying to have us pick from a book that from a list of books that I've already bought that I haven't read because I really have bought these books wanting to read them and wanting to talk about them on the show. But I also realize maybe that's a little selfish and maybe I should just put it to a general vote. I don't know. They're good books. So maybe I'll send out a list and see if you guys can agree on one of them, or maybe we can do something where we read multiple, or like, I don't know if I have time to read multiple books in a given time frame. But maybe we can do something where we split the work and, that sort of thing. So we'll see. Some people want a Facebook group. Some people don't want a Facebook group. I'm going to send out an email. Here's what I'll do. I'm going to wait a few days after this, and then I'm going to send out a group email where everyone can see everyone's email. If you're worried about some other awesome listener seeing your email, which I don't know why you would be, but just in case anyone is worried about anonymity or something, let me know and I'll just like blind copy you or something. But, otherwise, I'd say like Friday, I'm going to send out the group email, to everybody. And then we'll, at the very least, we'll have a book club email group and thread going. So that'll be good. And then we can figure out from there what we want to do. All right. Enough of that. Enough of all of that. Let's get to David Hume. Now, there are a couple of selections of his in here, and we're just going to do the first one. I'm really looking forward to doing Of Miracles. I actually think I've I think I've read of miracles before, but I'm very happy to do so again. So a little background on Hume. In case anyone doesn't already know, David Hume was a Scottish philosopher who lived from 1711 to 1776. Interesting, he died in 1776. He is widely regarded as one of the greatest philosophers who has ever written in the English language. Hume was born to socially connected but not a wealthy family. His father died when he was two, and so his mother took care of him and his siblings. And she apparently realized how just precocious he was. He was very brilliant, very young, because she allowed him to go with his brother to Edinburgh University, despite the fact that he was only like 10 or 11. I think maybe there, it's unclear exactly what year it was, but he was somewhere in the range of 10, 11, maybe 12, which is pretty crazy. Even if he's 12, that's still pretty early to go to university. He studied Latin and Greek and read history and literature and ancient and modern philosophy. Modern being at the time, I guess, modern as of 1722. He also did some mathematics and natural philosophy, which we know as science, but back then was just called natural philosophy. His family wanted him to become a lawyer because, again, I mean, they didn't have much money, but he found law just so boring that he couldn't do it. So he decided he wanted to be a scholar and a philosopher. At around the age of 18, he had some sort of epiphany, and he decided he wanted to spend like 10 years reading and writing because he had some breakthrough that I don't know if I read through it a little bit, but no one really enumerated what it was. But he had some sort of epiphany, and maybe it's something that's in his work. I don't know. Maybe that's something someone's written about. I'm not sure. I didn't find anything on it just with a quick search. But anyway, some sort of epiphany. And so he spent years just reading and writing and trying to get by because, again, he didn't have money. Now, if you or I did this based on some sort of epiphany, people would probably think we were nuts. But since he's David Hume, it turns out he probably was actually just brilliant and did have some sort of epiphany. But he studied so much and just committed so much to that he actually had some sort of breakdown, which it seems to be common among super smart people like that. Who's that? I'm blanking on the name, but the son of the, was it Mill? You know, the utilitarian. I think his son, like, he made his son study really, really hard, and then his son had a breakdown, but still ended up, is it Stuart Mill? I think that's what it is. Anyway, you can tell I prepared that part. No, he had a breakdown, and doctors diagnosed it as some weird thing that I don't think actually exists, but they said it was like a student or a learner's break, like some weird thing where you're just learning too much. So you have like these health problems. And I don't really think that's a real condition. But at any rate, he had some sort of breakdown, but he eventually recovered and at some point was able to write his first work, A Treatise of Human Nature. This is now regarded as one of the greatest books in Western philosophy, but as is often the case, it wasn't well received at the time. Hume also, he did end up taking out all the controversial parts to try to gain the favor of someone named Joseph Butler. I'm not sure that was, but maybe it was somebody who had influence that he was trying to impress. Despite this, though, he was very quickly labeled an atheist, and this is a part of his reputation that would follow him forever and actually cause him quite a bit of trouble. I think he lost a few jobs because people thought he was an atheist, and it's all because he just wrote, you know, certain things. Isn't that weird? If people were really secure in their beliefs, they would not have this thing where they're trying to out someone who might be an atheist just because they wrote certain arguments in their book. You know, it's pretty crazy. But anyway, that's what happened back then. And I don't think it happens as much nowadays, but that's what it was. And it caused him some trouble, but he did eventually find financial success with a book he wrote, A History of England, which was over 1 million words. So this was a giant work he did. And it found mainstream success, so it allowed him to pursue his other works and his career. And then in 1775, being diagnosed with intestinal cancer, he arranged the posthumous release of all his most controversial writings. So all the stuff he had held back, I guess it's kind of fortunate that he was diagnosed with something as opposed to just dying in his sleep or whatever, because he arranged for all the stuff that he held back and censored kind of, to be released after he died, which is, we can be thankful for that because it's some good writing. And I think that's part of the reading for today. So I always like to read Hitch's little intro. We get a chance to hear the great Hitch. Despite the fact that he's no longer with us, we can hear some of his words. Of the many distinguished thinkers of the 18th century Enlightenment, I have chosen the brilliant Scottish philosopher David Hume. He was less flamboyant in his criticism of religion than Baron D'Holbach or Edward Gibbon, with both of whom he was in contact, but his dry understatement and rigor are in many ways more persuasive. After his treatment, it was no longer possible to discuss miracles or the argument from so-called design with quite the same confidence as before. In the first passage here, Hume shows the man-made origins of faith and its reliance upon superstition. In the second, he subjects miraculous claims to a common-sense interrogation that reveals their spurious nature. It was an axiom among the faithful, and still is in some quarters, that atheists on their deathbeds would recant and call for a priest. Many false and cynical rumors of this kind were spread by the godly, about Thomas Paine in particular. We are extremely fortunate in having a first-hand account by the greatest of English biographers of David Hume's last hours. So that's it. Yeah, that is something actually Hitch would mention quite a bit, that people would fake deathbed confessions and stuff about atheists back in the day. But I don't think Hitch fell prey to that, or I don't think anyone would believe it if you tried to spread that lie. But anyway, let's get on to our reading. So he opens by asserting that religion is a product of anxiety about future events and uncertainty, that humans, by their nature, will dream up every bad thing possible and ascribe to it sort of an invisible force. It's not the most scientific statement I've heard, but I think he'll elaborate here. So here's another kind of religion. So that's one kind of religion, I guess. He says, here's this one kind of aspect or variety of religion where it's everything bad that can happen, and then we just assign that to a force. And then there's another kind where it's everything good, every good quality we can dream up, every amazing feature, all that, we just ascribe it to God. He has a great quote here. It is esteemed a sufficient confirmation of them that they give us more magnificent ideas of the divine objects of our worship and our adoration. So the point he's making is, this is something that's always bothered me. Religious people always justify this by just defining God as the greatest possible being. And then once you just say, well, he's the greatest possible being, and if you believe in him, then you can just give him whatever qualities you want. And Hume's point is that there's no constraint. It's just sort of a contest to ascribe and to give these, you know, great features and describe them and dream up new and better, amazing things about God. So that's definitely something I think is very true, and that happens. So now he says these two different human patterns that he's mentioned, these both go into religion. So there's a fear of horrible things and a desire to praise things. This part is great. People believe that no secret can be kept from God, so they start feeling like they can't have any sort of negative thoughts about him. So, well, I'll just read a quote. All must be applause, ravishment, and ecstasy, and while their gloomy apprehensions make them ascribe to him measures of conduct which in human creatures would be highly blamed, they must still affect to praise and admire that conduit in the object of their devotional addresses. So it's exactly, I don't know if you followed that, but essentially it's like, I think this all the time. God supposedly has all these qualities that we would absolutely hate if a person displayed. I mean, if a person demanded to be worshipped, how stupid would you think they were? How, maybe not stupid, but just like how psychologically weak would you think they are that they need to be worshipped all the time? Or, you know, all these other things like this jealousy, this, all this stuff. Yet because his thesis, I guess, which I mean, it's not proven or anything, but he's speculating that it's a result of people having this perfect notion of God, that he knows everything, that he can read into your mind and all that. That's what causes this, because despite the fact that people probably know better, they think, oh, he, you know, I can't have any negative thoughts about him because he's by definition great. So that's how they reconcile it. So here, Hume drives the point home even further. He references an ancient Greek author who pointed out how weird it was that the gods' behavior at the time, not God as we know, but, you know, the Greek gods, their behavior, the incest, rape, war, all this weird stuff that they did, is stuff that we severely punish when humans do it. But when gods do it, it's worshipped. It's like celebrated. Hume thinks the same goes for modern religion. If people allow for different behavior in princes, and that is something that they would do back then. I mean, it's princes and you know, royalty are sort of above everybody else and are allowed to do kind of whatever. How much further still would they go to make allowances for God? And then he quotes, "The gods have their own laws," which is some ancient quote. This paragraph is great, so I'm going to read some of it. Where are we? "Here I cannot forbear observing a fact which may be worth the attention of such as make human nature the object of their inquiry. It is certain that in every religion, however sublime the verbal definition which it gives of its divinity, many of the votaries, perhaps the greatest number, will still seek the divine favor not by virtue and good morals, which alone can be acceptable to a perfect being, but either by frivolous observances, by intemperate zeal, by rapturous ecstasies, or by the belief of mysterious and absurd opinions." So that's really great. Let's see, how much do I want to summarize here? He notes that for, I think he says this later on, and so I may be taking some of my later thunder, but he essentially was saying there that it's people don't just behave good, you know, behave well or just be good, which would be things that he would think are plenty for a perfect God. A perfect being would just want you to be good. They go over the top with all this weird, you know, behavior and ritual and stuff. So it would be sufficient to a real God, he thinks, to just do good deeds. And I agree. To be a good person, that would be all you'd need to do. To be honest and fair and all that, just have good qualities. Why would any perfect being demand, you know, worship and all that? But Hume points out several moral absurdities of ancient religions and religious texts in order to show that this isn't what really happens. So there's some disconnect between those two things. What actually happens is a bunch of weird, you know, stuff that he points out, like in ancient religion. And I'm going to read some again. "Nay, if we should suppose what never happens, that a popular religion were found in which it was expressly declared that nothing but morality could gain the divine favor, if an order of priests were instituted to inculcate this opinion in daily sermons, and with all the arts of persuasion, yet so inveterate are the people's prejudices that for want of some other superstition, they would make the very attendance on these sermons the essentials of religion rather than place them in virtue and good morals." So that's basically he said. I mean, it's speculation, but I agree with the speculation. He's saying that even if there were a religion where people just said, all you have to do is be good, that's all you got to do, people are so superstitious that they would start feeling like, oh, I need to go to these sermons where people say, just be good. Like that's what I need to do. I need to score these points. And that's maybe less true now. I think there are a lot more people now who just think like, oh, I need to be good. Or they don't even think that. They think just by accepting Jesus, then they're fine. So it's maybe a little different now, but back then, maybe that it was more so. So then Hume goes on to say that it's difficult to account for these facts. So he thinks there's some mystery here. He thinks that no man could be so stupid as to not realize that a deity would simply value honesty and goodness above all else and would not care about devotion or worship. I've always thought this. One thing I remember very vividly is being super young in church, just thinking like, why do we go through all this? God knows everything going on in your head. Why do we go to church? What does that matter? Why do we pray? Why do we do any, like, he already knows all our thoughts. And I think it sounds like Hume saying the same thing, but Hume thinks that no one could be so stupid as to not realize this. Now, there is a possibility that maybe, you know, maybe people are that stupid, but we'll go with him. Hume doesn't seem to think so. He thinks it's a mystery that this phenomenon he's described where people do more than just behave well. He thinks there's something to investigate here. Something's going on. So that's interesting. So we'll follow his argument. The next possibility he explores is whether people substitute these other things instead of good moral behavior because they're easier. So that's his first. So there's a mystery going on here. And Hume says, well, here's one possibility. Are people just doing these rituals and stuff because they're easier and being moral is harder? So they're sort of substituting. But he dismisses this argument. So he sort of poses an argument and then just dismisses it by saying, some of the things that they do, some of the superstitions and rituals people go through are actually a lot harder than just being moral. I mean, there's Ramadan, there's you don't eat or drink, and it's the middle of summer, and just all this. He describes several practices like that that are a lot harder than simply being a good person. So, having dismissed this possibility, Hume goes on to offer a solution to this little conundrum. So, his writing here is a little difficult, I'll say, but I think I get the gist of what he's saying. He's saying in his argument, his proposed solution to this problem is that if God were real, all that would matter is moral duties and behaving well. Now, and then we've already mentioned this, fulfilling societal and familial obligations would be part of that. But Hume speculates that men already have this natural drive to do these duties, and there's sort of already a bit of a incentive to do so. So he thinks that there's this obligation and good feeling, and this combines to make it so that it doesn't feel like work to do these things. However, this instinct, now this is my word, he doesn't use the word instinct. I just want to make, because that would be kind of interesting. But the instinct to be good actually becomes problematic if a person is already doing his duties willingly. So that's the gist of what he's saying. I'll try to explain it a little more. So Hume thinks a person will feel like they're not really earning God's favor, pretty much. This makes sense to me. People need to feel like they're doing something really difficult. Otherwise, what is the value of the thing they're providing? Like if I say, in the name of God, in order to serve God, I'm going to eat a bunch of pizza and watch some hockey. It's not really that great of a service because that's something I want to do anyway. So if I thought God wanted these things, Hume is saying, I wouldn't feel satisfied because it's like, well, this is what God wants me to do, but I kind of want to do this anyway. So I'd still have this instinct of like, hey, I need to do more. So, but if I do something I hate, like if I watch baseball, for example, or if I don't eat, if I fast, do other behaviors that I'm sure you can think of that many people do, just weird stuff, then I feel like I'm really giving something to God. So I think his point is that people need to feel like they're sacrificing something, and just being morally good doesn't really satisfy that feeling, the desire to sacrifice something, because it's not terribly difficult, he thinks. Now, I think for a lot of people it is, and I think there are, even for good people, there are lots of situations where it's very hard to be morally good. So I don't know that his argument is waterproof or watertight here, but it makes sense to me that this is some part of it, that there is some instinct that people have that they really need to be sacrificing something for God, when in reality, why would God want that? So I think I agree with the conclusion, but not quite with the reasoning. But anyway, here's a quote. But if he fast a day or give himself a sound whipping, this has a direct reference, in his opinion, to the service of God. No other motive could engage him to do such austerities. By these distinguished marks of devotion, he has now acquired the divine favor and may expect in recompense protection and safety in this world and eternal happiness in the next. So that makes sense. Kind of more of what I said. It's like people feel like they need to do something that there's no other reason for them to do. And then that means they're doing it just for God. And then they sort of expect, but the irony there, which this isn't something Hume points out here, I don't know if he ever talks about it later, but the irony there is that they still are just doing it for that feeling that they're going to get something from God in return. Like, so they set this all up. They're doing something. They're whipping themselves. They're doing, you know, other weird, like, religious kind of austerities, as he puts it. But still, they're just doing it to get some benefit from God. So it's, you can't really do anything truly selfless. But anyway, Hume says, because of this, it's not safe to judge a man's morals by his devotion. He thinks sometimes the worst qualities in people can produce the most superstitious fear. He cites some historical examples of people you've never heard of, of people who are bad, people who were really also very superstitious. I suppose we're back in time too far to hope for like a study on this. That was the first thing I thought of. It's interesting nowadays that you can't, I mean, you can, but you can't do too much serious, you know, writing about this kind of thing while just speculating. If you want to really publish something that people will take seriously, you got to go collect some data, you know, find people, prisoner inmates or people who are convicted of crimes, determine if they feel a lot of superstitious guilt for it or whatever. And maybe you'd find something, maybe not. But it's interesting. I was just thinking back then, you know, maybe that wasn't really even something people would think to do. You know, for one thing, it's a lot harder back then to gather that data. So that's a big part of it. But I wonder if even that methodology was kind of developed. But anyway, let's see. So yeah, this makes sense. So basically the idea of what he's saying here is people, sometimes the worst people, the most guilty people are the most superstitious and the most devout. So he's saying you can't really, if you see someone who's really religious, really, you know, practicing all these austerities and whatever, it's not a good indicator of their character because he thinks sometimes guilt can drive that. And sometimes it's people who like do something really bad and think, okay, but I'm going to make up for it by doing all this sacrifice for God. So that's what he's saying there. And then we're already on the last paragraph. So I usually like to read the last paragraph just because it's the last one. I don't know. To which we may add that after the commission of crimes, there arise remorses and secret horrors. Oh, this is kind of what I already said, which give no rest to the mind, but make it have recourse to religious rites and ceremonies as expiations for its offenses. Whatever weakens or disorders the internal frame promotes the interest of superstition. And nothing is more destructive to them than a manly, steady virtue, which either preserves us from disastrous, melancholy accidents or teaches us to bear them. Not done, but I'll read one more sentence. During such calm sunshine of the mind, these specters of false divinity never make their appearance. You know, that's so true. And that's even not being religious, that's something that I find to be true. Like when I'm talking to people who are really religious or like have a lot of guilt or that sort of thing, or say or think I'm going to hell for being an atheist, I always just think I'm just going to go ahead and be a good person, do my best. I'm going to not kill anyone. Or I mean, I know it's hard, but I'm going to not kill anyone. I'm going to not do anything bad. And I don't really have this feeling of like, oh, what's going to happen when I die? Because it's like, you know, even if by some strange, bizarre chance there was a God, I really don't think it's consistent with the world we find ourselves in. But somehow if there were, and they were all powerful, I'm still fine. I mean, I've been a good person, and an all-powerful God is going to see that and is going to see, especially... Guys, especially check out the competition. Like, maybe relative to some perfect paradigm, I'm not a good person. I don't know. Like, maybe relative to some fake perfect human. But just check out everyone else in the world. I mean, I think I'm doing pretty good. That's why sometimes I think, like, man, I'm not smart at all compared to some of these smart people. Like, you read David Hume or, you're reading someone else or you're seeing a talk or, you know, lecture or something. You're like, man, I'm so dumb compared to this person. And then you go to work and you're like, Maybe I'm pretty smart. I'm pretty smart compared to these people. So which is it? I don't know. But just if we, it's just a thought I had just now, like, especially if God grades on a curve, I think I'm doing totally fine in terms of heaven. I think I should be in the top. Yeah, I'm not a great person, but I think I'm doing okay. I think I can think of a lot worse people. So as long as you can find, like, you know, all you have to do is outrun the slower person, and then when a bear is chasing you or whatever. No. So anyway, where was I? But I find that to be true. It's funny when I see people so panicked. I mean, it's not funny, but it's funny in a weird way. Like, odd seeing people so panicked about being good and religion, all that. And Hume is saying here that the best antidote to superstition is just being kind of stoic and just being good. Like, oh, just be a steady, good person. And then that's an antidote to superstition, because if you're just steady and you're good and you do your obligations, you do your thing, like, there's no reason you need to fear all this stuff. Now, this is not really taking into account. That's the thing about some philosophy that's this old, and still definitely there's some great thoughts in here and everything. I'm not trying to say it's bad or anything, but, like, one thing it seems like people didn't take into account, even Hume, even the great Hume, who was an atheist, is, like, there's a wide range of human quality of mind and stuff. And I don't know, maybe there'll be some later reading where he'll say something, but it's like, I don't think this advice applies to everyone. There are lots of people who just have mental qualities that make it so they are really superstitious and they can't help it. Like, it doesn't, just because someone's superstitious doesn't mean they've done something wrong. He could be right that it correlates, like, maybe more people who do stuff wrong are more superstitious, but it could be, I mean, as far as Hume knows, it very well could be that he's just of sound mind and lots of people are just of a superstitious mind and have a harder time being kind of the stoic person that he's describing. So that's something that's what comes to mind for me nowadays, but I don't know. It's still interesting. So on the other hand, while we abandon ourselves to the natural undisciplined suggestions of our timid and anxious hearts, every kind of barbarity is ascribed to the Supreme Being. From the terrors with which we are agitated and every kind of caprice from the methods which we embrace in order to appease him. Barbarity, caprice, these qualities, however nominally disguised, we may universally observe, form the ruling character of the deity in popular religions. Even priests, instead of correcting these depraved ideas of mankind, have often been found ready to foster and encourage them. The more tremendous the divinity is represented, the more tame and submissive do men become his ministers, and the more unaccountable the measures of acceptance required by him, the more necessary does it become to abandon our natural reason and yield to their ghostly guidance and direction. Thus it may be allowed that the artifices of men aggravate our natural infirmities and follies of this kind, but never originally beget them. Their root strikes deeper in the mind and springs from the essential and universal properties of human nature. So that's the end. Now, that was 4 pages. You see why this project could this is right here is job security. I don't think I could ever get through. No, that's not true. Someday I'll get through this whole book, but it's going to take longer than the Bible, because unlike the Bible, there's a lot of good thought in here and there's sentences that are kind of hard to work out because they're very complicated and they're, you know, you have to work out the logic of them and all that. Whereas the Bible is just like, the Jews are terrible. Here's what they did. Blah, 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 blah. And that's basically the entire Bible. So you don't need to read it. I just summarized the entire thing. So yeah, that was 4 pages. It took a while. I'm really excited to get to the next part. I know, again, I touched on it earlier this week. Everyone has kind of different things they want out of the podcast. And I know maybe some of you don't like this segment. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback on it, actually, but maybe people don't like it, so that's why I don't do it all the time. I do it occasionally, but I think I'm doing it a little too occasionally because it's been months. And I think before the last one I did, it had been months and months. So I may try to do the next Hume one sooner rather than later. But I also got those comments to do. So much stuff, guys. There's so much stuff to tell you. Well, with that said, we need to thank our patrons. One new patron this week, Paul Maltby. Thank you so much. It's always really, really cool to get a new patron. It's a great feeling. Thank you for joining the esteemed company of my other patrons. And then I've got to thank my top patrons, which goes a little something like this. Zimuzinu, Adrian Borschoff, Michael, Jonathan Moyer, Havard S., Jay Aldenwalt, Bangs Naughty Bits, Peter Skelton, Brian Garefort, Dale, Matt Garrett, and honorable mention to Samantha. Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate your support. And I hope to continue growing the show and doing good things and earning your support because you guys are very generous and I want to do the best that I can do. So thank you. Thank you very much. And all patrons, don't ever hesitate to message me or anything if anything you want to say at all. I'm open to any comments, feedback, or just a hello. Either way. So thank you guys, and I will see you on Monday.